If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Laura Stanfill, author of the new book, Imagine a Door, A Writer's Guide to Unlocking Your Story, Choosing a Publishing Path, and Honoring the Creative Journey, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. Laura's debut novel, Singing Lessons for the Stylish Canary, came out in 2022 from Lanternfish Press, and her writing has appeared in Shondaland, The Rumpus, Catapult, Santa Fe Writers Project, and several print anthologies. Laura is the founder of Forest Avenue Press, a Portland-based indie publisher now in its 13th year. As an author and publisher, Laura has banked an extensive amount of inside information and wisdom. In Imagine a Door, she very generously shares it with writers new and established, seeking to get their books sold and out to readers. She's a very kind, supportive, and much-loved member of our local literary community, and it's a great joy for me to welcome her back to Jonesy. Before we get started, a reminder that KABU is in the final days of our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign going on through April 15th. You can check out our full list of specials and marathons at kabu.fm/ATNF4. Please join us now for our conversation with Laura Stanfill, which is already in progress. Laura, it's so good to talk with you again for the show. The last time was for the release of your novel, Singing Lessons for the Stylish Canary. That was almost 3 years ago to the day.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, that novel, by the way, your first published novel, plays an important part in the writing of your newest book, Imagine a Door. You started that novel in 2007 and had been working on it for 15 years before publishing it in 2022. You founded Forest Avenue Press in 2012. So in your professional life, writer precedes publisher. In fact, you go way back as a writer to your childhood.
Absolutely. I was writing books in grade school back in the day, and I grew up wanting to be a writer. I think I knew I wanted to be a writer in second grade. So,
and you had teachers that encouraged you.
I sure did. All the way through, I found teachers who understood what writing meant to me and recognized that I had a skill in that area, and then they encouraged me.
And you even have some of their reports in this book, which must be in your parents' voluminous Laura archive.
Yes, I'm an only child, so there is a massive archive of all of my old report cards and stories and poems and doodles. Yeah.
So going way back as a writer, you were first introduced to others in the Portland literary community as a writer. And you were a member of several workshops, including the Pinewood Table, which is led by Stephen Allred and Joanna Rose, whose own books you later published with Forest Avenue. Was that around that time you started writing Singing Lessons for the Stylish Canary?
It was actually earlier. I moved to Portland in 2001, and I believe I joined the Pinewood Table the first time in 2002. I moved to the beach for 2 years and left and then came back.
You were
again.
A journalist there?
Yes, exactly.
Was that in Cannon Beach?
No, that was in Lincoln City.
Ah.
Yeah.
And as a writer working on your own, what was it like to become part of these writing groups, part of this community of fellow writers? And you talk a lot about community in the new book.
Well, when I first got here, I knew I needed to find people who were doing the same work of writing as me just to connect and to feel like I belonged here. And so I started a writing group at Annie Bloom's upstairs in their little office area. And people showed up. People came and they joined my writing group and they shared their work and we talked about it. And one of the people who came was Steve Arndt.
The connector.
The connector, yes. Steve Arndt.
He's such a great guy. And he, by connector, I mean that he's always introducing people to other people. And they make their own connections, and it just grows from there. But he's so good at that and
exactly.
very generous.
He was definitely the foundation of my finding community here. He told me about Stephen and Joanna and the Pinewood Table, and then he drove me over to a class to let me experience their teaching. And then I was like, I am in. I want to learn from these writers. And it taught me so much about being a writer in terms of the craft, but it also taught me what it was like to sit in community with writers who have very different voices and styles and subject matters. But we all belong to each other because we sat down at the Pinewood Table together.
And you knew you weren't alone.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
You weren't kind of fighting that lonely battle with
exactly.
the page.
Exactly. It can be so hard to be an artist in a world where everything moves really fast, and to write something and to stick with it is about tuning all the rest of it out. So getting to spend time with people who do that also is like, okay, we are doing the same thing. This is great. We should all keep doing it. So
now you started Forest Avenue Press about 5 years after starting work on the novel. In the About This Book section of Imagine a Door, you write, I became a publisher in 2012 so I could learn how the industry works and share the information with writers on the outside. But you also had a flash of inspiration on a visit to Powell's bookstore in downtown Portland. I think it was around 2011, when you came across something kind of new and flashy, the espresso book machine.
Those were good times. Powell's had brought in an espresso book machine to print books inside the store. It was located on the Purple Room. And I wanted to know how it worked and why, and I sat down with the person who worked there at the time, Polly Dugan, who is also a very well-known Portland author. At that time, neither of us had been published, and I said, I should make a book. I'd like to do this, and she said, yes, you should make a book, and so Forest Avenue began with those very hyper-local roots.
Thanks to these advances in technology.
Yeah, it was so neat because you could... It had a moment of popularity back then, and I think there are still machines out there. But the idea of being able to send data to a printer and have that printer not just print out regular pages, but trim and bind a book and glue the spine on and have a real book come out of it was really exciting to me. That's super local. Like, it was sort of the next step up from making a zine with your hands. You could send in the file and they would make the book.
And a pretty professional looking result.
Yeah, absolutely. It looked like a real book.
Now, as long as we're talking about the roots of Forest Avenue Press, I've been reading your books, Forest Avenue books, for several years and interviewing many of your authors each year. I didn't know why you called it Forest Avenue Press. I was guessing it was just an address of yours from way back, but the answer is actually revealed in the book.
Absolutely. I went to Forest Avenue School in elementary school and...
In New Jersey.
In New Jersey, yeah. And in fourth grade, we had to pick an object and write a story from the perspective of that object. And I got really into it. I wrote about a red bouncy ball at recess. And for some reason, I can't remember now, the ball ended up traveling to Europe and having all these adventures in the Black Forest. And I worked so hard on it. And the librarian said, would you like to learn how to bind this? Do you want, I think you should turn this into a book and I will teach you how to hand bind it. And so we used cardboard and fabric and glue, and she helped me bind it into a real book.
Do you still have that book?
No,
It's not in your parents' archives.
It's not in the archive. Maybe a draft of it is somewhere, but I donated that bound copy to the library at Forest Avenue School because I wanted other kids to know they could make their books also.
Have you been back to see if it's still there?
I have not. I'm sure it isn't. It's been so many years.
Right next to Pippi Longstocking and Frogger.
Totally.
Now, founding your own indie press seems a daunting task, maybe even more so than writing and selling a novel. And I know you've said no one told you how hard it would be. You write in the book that at the time, publishing sounded like, I'm quoting, maximum fun. That was kind of a blessing, though, not knowing that parts of it weren't so fun.
I don't think I would have known how to get started if I knew how big the publishing project would be. Because I wanted to make one book at one time on one espresso book machine, it seemed doable. And then, of course, I fell in love with publishing and kept going. And there are so many bits and pieces and details of how to put a book together, not to mention all the business side of figuring out how to sell books, figuring out how not to spend more money than you're earning back, that sort of thing. Doing accounting, doing royalties. How do you set up a royalty accounting station that makes sense?
And so, all that knowledge is shared in the new book.
Yep, I tried.
I have this quote from Leland Chuck in the book. Yeah. And Leland, I actually interviewed one of his authors. He's an author. Leland is an author, stand-up comedian too, but also a publisher. He founded 713 Books for debut novels. And he tells you, which you write in the book, publishing is probably one of the only businesses out there where there are more ways to lose money than make it. And Forest Avenue, of course, is still going after 13 years, but I guess you would agree with Leland. There's pitfalls along the way you got to watch out for.
Absolutely. When you start thinking about what goes into making a book, if you want to pay freelancers, editors and designers and other professionals to help you make a good book, that adds up cost-wise. And then when you want to send books out to reviewers so that you can get publicity for them, those costs add up. It's not just the paper cost and the time cost. That's so many bits and pieces.
Your first book was a story collection by Stephen Allred, A Simplified Map of the Real World. And Stephen was one of the leaders of that Pinewood Table writing group you were a part of. That book came out in September 2013, so about a year after you started the press. And it must have been quite a learning experience ramping up from starting a press to publishing your first book.
It was nuts. We did publish on the Espresso Book Machine a little anthology called Brave on the Page, and that went out of print pretty early on.
Oh, I don't know that title.
Yeah, I'll have to see if I can find one in my archives for you. But it was a series of interviews and essays by local writers, and I did the interviews with local writers. And so it was a celebration of Portland literary community. And it aged pretty quickly because a lot of the interviews were like, my book is forthcoming. And, you know, a year later, the book is out. So, or somebody has their second book coming out. And so when we got national distribution with Publishers Group West, I decided to let that go out of print. We also never did a print run. It was only available on the Espresso Book Machine. So our first real title, single author title, was Stephen's book.
Which is still in print.
And he came back with his second book, which we published.
Ale House at the End of the World. Huh?
2019, I think. Yeah.
And those are among your more popular titles, right?
Yes.
With the anthology City of Weird.
Yes.
Edited by Gigi Little.
Yeah, exactly. And it was such a joy and so scary to say yes to Stephen's book because I admired him so much.
You didn't want to mess up.
And I remember Gigi Little said, can you edit your mentor? Do you think you can edit Stephen? And I went, oh, I don't know. I guess I would have to if I want to publish his book. And so I realized like, okay, that's the way through. So I'm going to say yes. And I'm going to figure out how to edit someone I admire so much. And that was really, it was a pleasure to work with Stephen that on that first book, because there were no expectations on either side. It was just, let's make a thing together and let's make it as beautiful as we can.
But there had to be a lot of trust between you.
There was so much trust.
Him to trust you to publish his book and you to trust him that you accepted the book for your first fiction title.
Exactly. We talked a lot about that and about our appreciation of each other and how this was the right thing to do for both of us. So it was a really special experience. You can only have one first single author book. You know, it was really, Brave on the Page was more of a community, like a collective effort. And Simplified Map was Stephen and me sitting at my kitchen table, working out copy editing together and fighting over commas. It was delightful.
Now, in 2016, about 4 years after the birth of Forest Avenue Press, you started writing the new book, Imagine a Door. And that was one of your goals of starting a press, which I mentioned before, learning how the industry works and sharing that information. And to do that, you first leverage your years as a journalist by doing a series of interviews. So your years, not just in Lincoln City as a journalist, but also, I think, Willamette Week, did you do some work journalism?
No, I was never at Willamette Week.
Oregonian?
Not the Oregonian. Oh. I was at what until recently was known as Pamplin Media Group. I was the Sherwood Gazette editor.
Oh, okay.
And I was the editor, managing editor of Lincoln City News Guard. And before that, I did freelance work and worked for another community paper in Fairfax County, Virginia. So
you were used to doing interviews, and that's how you started this one, huh?
Exactly. And I didn't have a title or a concept for this project back in 2016 when I started. I just knew that I had access to people who had information about how to get a book into the world and best practices for query letters and what makes a good title. And I felt like I'm learning so much that I can apply to my own writing career, but how cool and important would it be if I could take that information that I have access to as a publisher, somebody in the industry, and share it back with everybody else. So that's where the idea for the interviews came from.
And do you remember some of those first interviews? They're probably in the book, right?
They are in the book, yeah. Some of them are really old. Dan Lazar was one of the really early ones, and I had to go back to him, and I asked him what makes a good title. And he's a big name agent at Writer's House. And he wanted to update some of the titles that he really liked because he's been the agent for so many more books than he was back then.
So he kind of knows what sells.
Or
he's learned over the years.
Definitely a lot of the early interviews were agents telling me to share with people how to get a deal and how to get representation. And what was really cool is going back almost 10 years and following up with those agents and making sure the quote still worked, the information was still the same. Like the industry has not really changed in some ways, and in other ways it has, of course.
But now, based on those interviews and your publishing experience, you finished a first draft of the book and sent it to a few readers for feedback. But you said at your PAL's launch you weren't quite satisfied with it. You said the first draft was too journalistic.
Yeah.
Too impersonal or?
Yeah. I mean, at that time, it took me a really long time to call myself a publisher. I would say I started a publishing house or I'm an editor. I edit books. I edit manuscripts. But I wouldn't say I'm a book publisher because nobody told me I could be one. I just decided I was going to. It's like grabbing a crown and being like, ta-da.
Being a writer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
when,
nobody tells you.
When can I start calling myself a writer?
Totally.
Do I need a book out? Do I just need to sit down and write something?
Totally. And so it took me a little while to get to the point of calling myself a publisher and to believing what I had to say mattered. And it took a lot longer to realize that my story around book publishing and how my personal writing life was, it should actually be a part of the story.
Yeah, the PAL's reading, you were in conversation with Joanna Rose, your other mentor at the Pinewood table, along with Stephen. She called the book both a reference and a memoir. And the ups and downs of writing, submitting, and publishing your first novel provided the memoir part. Can you talk about that first novel's path, which you talk about extensively in the new book, from finished manuscript to published book? And man, there were a lot of obstacles along the way.
Yeah, there were some of them I placed in front of myself by accident. I didn't mean to, but that's kind of how it happened. I had had a couple novels before that went out to one went out to New York with an agent and never sold. And I submitted my second novel to that agent, and it was 2008-ish. The economy had tanked. People weren't buying as much in New York right then in terms of literary fiction. And so she was like, you're free, go off, do whatever. And that permission of not having an agent waiting for my book is what sparked me to write a 19th century historical, magical romp of a music box tale.
Which we talked about 3 years ago.
Yeah. And I think had I been trying to writing for an agent or writing for a particular goal is like trying to write to a prompt. And when we get too narrow-minded and focus on that prompt or that expectation, we can cut out a lot of our creativity, or we can be setting ourselves up for terrible disappointment when whatever we're hoping to get doesn't come through.
Because it's kind of writing to what you think people want to read.
Exactly.
The agent and the publisher wants to buy, and then the bookstores will want to stock.
Exactly. One example is vampire fiction, let's just say vampire fiction is hot. If somebody sits down and says, oh, I'm going to write something about vampires, by the time they finish writing, revising again, getting representation, getting a publisher, that'll be an old trend.
We're on to werewolves. Sir.
Yeah, we're on to exactly werewolves. So it's important to listen to yourself and figure out what you want to do and who you want to be. And a lot of my issues with my first novel, I self-created by trying to listen to other people's advice. And I really didn't center my own thoughts about the book and what it could be. I just, every time I got an agent rejection that said, well, I would like this if... And they would give me an offer for a revise and resubmit.
You spent a lot of time doing some revisions.
Yeah.
Based on agents' feedback.
I did, I think it was about 15 years from my first inkling of an idea to when the book came out. And big chunks of years in there were because I was revising for a specific person and who had given me advice very kindly and had requested seeing the manuscript again. So I would go head down for like a year and work on the book, send it back out. And the agent, of course, had moved on. They had so many other things they were doing. They had other projects in the queue. And often I got the, well, I don't think that works either. Or that's not quite what I thought it would be.
That must be so demoralizing, spending all that time.
Yeah, it was really hard. And I look back now, I said this at Powell's as well, but I look back now and think that probably that book at its 5-year mark was as good as any version of it. And maybe if I had known how amazing small presses are and had started at small presses at that 5-year mark, that one would have come out sooner and I would have more books out. But as it was, I was really chasing that New York deal of having the agent sell the book to a major house and have it become a big thing.
We'll talk about that too, the different types of publishers, which you go into in the book. But at the Powell event, you said you experienced writing and submitting the novel for publication, and what happened after Lanternfish Press accepted became the spine of the book. And as a publisher yourself, you can provide a lot of valuable information on query letters, contracts, distribution, and promotion, which you do. But your experience as an author, I think, strengthens the connection between you and your readers, who are mostly fellow writers. You know what they're going through.
Absolutely. I've had multiple people come up to me, even though the book just launched, and say, I feel so seen by this book. Being a writer is really hard, and I just wanted to put my experience of looking for the right publisher, breaking up with I didn't break up with my agent at that time, but I ended up selling it to a small press with my agent's help. The voice of the book is so much my voice because I am there with the other authors who are looking for a place for their
work. And the writers reading the book can sense that.
Exactly.
As you said, I feel seen.
And it feels really important too to have said, like, I've made these mistakes or I've had these rejections, and share that intimate, honest perspective, because a lot of what we share, you know, I want to put share in quotes here. We share things on social media all the time, and it's all the good stuff, right?
I'll
post about, I'm on KBOO. But there are so many hard days and hard moments in the industry when you're trying to break in, when you're trying to get through the door or get past a gatekeeper or have somebody even notice what you're doing and say it's good.
That writers would probably not share on social media.
Exactly, exactly.
Now imagine A Door took about 9 years from conception to print, but it could have taken longer if not for two events. And you mentioned this also at the Powell's launch. The first was a grant of $5,000 from Portland's Regional Arts and Culture Council. That gave you a boost of confidence in the project?
Yeah, I was...
In addition to the money.
Yeah, the money was amazing. And also I thought, oh no, now I have to finish this book. Somebody wants it. This is amazing. I didn't even have a title, or I didn't have this title for this project at that time. But I did have a budget because I had already been spending money and starting to figure out who was going to do developmental editing for me and how it was going to work. And so I wrote up my proposal kind of on a whim, thinking, well, if they don't fund it, it's okay. I'll just, you know, keep tinkering on this for a while longer. And then it got funded in the spring of 2023. And it made me realize, oh, yeah, I need to get this book out there. There are people, it is a community book. It's full of 75 plus, I think, interviews. It's with my voice as the glue and lots of other people's ideas and perspectives. And I thought, well, okay, if Rack thinks this is important and I've made a good case for it being a community project, then I owe it to my community and to myself to finish it. If I owed it just to myself, I think it would have been harder to say when and actually stop.
And it's kind of a badge of approval for the project by RAC. I mean, that's not an easy grant to get.
Yeah, I felt really lucky.
Now, the second event that accelerated the completion of the book had something to do with a broken foot.
Yeah, it was the day school got out or the day after school got out. And I went to the local park and I was just, you know, like tiptoeing through the daisies or the dandelions.
As one does in a park.
As one does in a park. And I was actually aiming for like a walkway that an accessible, ADA accessible walkway. And I thought, okay, I'll just like tra-la-la, frolic down the hill to the walkway. And then I'll just follow the walkway down to the playground. And on the way down the hill, I found a curb I didn't know was there. It was hidden under tall grass. And I fell right over the curb. I had been taking roller derby lessons. I was wearing sneakers at the time, but I fell in my really strong roller derby safety fall. And I ended up, so I didn't break my wrist or anything, but my foot got caught on that curb and it twisted. And somehow I drove myself home, even though it was my right foot, made it home. It was not very far, I promise. And then when I got confirmed that it was broken and I needed weeks of rest, I thought, aha, I will now sit on the couch with an elevated foot and I will finish the book for Rack and for everyone else. So I did. That's how it came about.
So the silver lining behind the broken foot.
Yeah, for sure.
Now let's talk about the title, Imagine a Door, which highlights an important part of your advice to writers. You write in the book's first few pages, publishing is a business. To get there, to the commercial side of things, in parentheses, which can be soul-crushing, first you have to learn to protect the magic, to create safe boundaries within which your brain can play. You have to imagine the door. I think play is the key word here because that's how many writers start out and may lose that sense. But what's the door?
Well, the way the title came about, the door that I write about in the opening is imagination and a sense of curiosity. When we're kids, we can make up stories all really easily. And we always, you know, even I used to scare myself because I would worry that someone was going to break in and rob us. Robbers were really big in Gen X. I don't know. I was either going to get stolen off the street or I was going to get robbed in my house while I was sleeping. So as kids, we're really good at imagining like, what could be on the other side of the door.
My sister and I were afraid of homicidal witches.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I love this. And also that's a lot. That's scary.
we had this apartment in Los Angeles when we were kids. And we would look out the window and we imagined this situation where we saw this kind of old woman on the street like a witch, and somebody's walking by and she kills the person. And then she looks up and she sees us looking at her. And all of a sudden we were on the third floor. We hear footsteps coming up the steps outside and we just scared ourselves doing that. So never wrote it down. I maybe it was done with Hitchcock's Rear Window. I think it was a similar theme.
Well, we lose that ability to just imagine and invent. And some of it is because we've learned that we're probably safe where we are. We don't have to make up stories and about fear so much. But the idea of anything could be behind the door and we don't have to imagine something specific felt like why I came up with this. It was very much even...
You have the door and then your mind is free to play with whatever you see beyond it.
Yeah.
Imagine beyond it.
I started off, you turn the handle and find yourself in a kitchen, courtyard, underground cave, jungle, corporate boardroom, bedroom, cockpit, dark alley, school. And those are all written sort of in a poem format. And so as that piece continues, the next piece follows in the same kind of poetic frame. And I just like the idea of playing with imagination. And then at the end of it, it's like, but then you realize that your idea will never sell. And
well, that's why you have the subtitle.
Exactly.
Which is very long. A writer's guide to unlocking your story, choosing a publishing path, and honoring the creative journey. So I think we get the idea. But the Imaginador is just a beautiful title.
I tried so many titles that didn't work or that sounded too similar to other people's titles. The one that I got the Rack Grant with, I was really proud of it until I tried to talk to people about it. I think that was the next to final title. It was the one I had before Imaginador. And it was In Progress. Because as writers, even when we finish something and sell it and it gets published, the next work is in progress. And as human beings, we grow. We're always in progress. And wherever we are on our journeys impacts what we write on the page. So I really like that idea of it being the title because it was open not just to debut authors or you know, brand new writers, but writers who were on their third and fourth book are still in progress with the next book and in progress learning something else about the world or about themselves. But In Progress made a terrible title to share with people. Well, Laura, what's your book about? Tell me about your book. Well, it's in progress.
Right. A little generic.
Yeah. It just didn't work. So.
And you have this great quote in the book about play and the importance of play. You also say this part, the investigation of the story, the sense of wonder and imagination, is the only piece of publishing that we can control.
Mm-hmm. It's true. The moment we send our work into the world and ask someone else to pay attention to it, we've lost control. The work stands on its own. But while we are writing, while we are revising, while we are retitling, because sometimes that needs to happen, we have creative control, artistic control, and we get to shape the story.
Now let's talk about a few of the pieces of publishing we can't control, and which you write about in the book, of course. And a big part of that is submitting and getting accepted. Now, as a publisher, you mentioned what you look for in a manuscript, and it's a process that's evolved over the years for you. Initially, you felt you had to read at least, I think, the first 50 pages, if not more, but then you learned to trust your instincts. Why so many pages in the beginning, and what do you look for now?
In the beginning, I was afraid of missing gold. I was, as somebody who has written many novels and rewritten many beginnings of novels, I thought, okay, well, first 5 pages, 10 pages, 20 pages aren't gripping me, but maybe the story starts a little bit later.
On page
I should
51.
Keep going. Yeah. And I think super early in some of those days, I would even go to a page 100 and just, you know, give the writer the love that I wanted as a writer. I wanted someone to read past the opening if the opening wasn't working and keep going. And it turns out when submissions are just, you have so many manuscripts coming in, it's really not.
You have hundreds coming in now.
Yeah, we have hundreds coming in when we're open for submissions, and we have a whole bunch come in when we are not open for submissions too.
Which you also talk about in the book.
Yeah.
It's not good etiquette.
No, I mean, I understand when people make mistakes, but I just got a coloring book submission this morning about, please put my coloring book into the world. And it's for kids, which we're not a kids publisher, and we don't publish art books or coloring books. So, you know, we get that kind of stuff all the time.
They need to read your book.
Yeah, they do.
You talk specifically about that, researching the publisher before just a blind submission.
Yep.
Now, you have a section of the book about appropriation, which interested me quite a bit, an author not writing from their lived experience, but from someone else's. And you give examples of Forest Avenue authors who I've interviewed and really enjoyed the books and talking with them. Annie Carl, who is the editor of the anthology Soul Jar, 31 Fantastical Tales by Disabled Authors. Neil Cochran, he wrote The Story of the 100 Promises, which is a fantasy novel with a trans protagonist. And one of your best friends, sadly she died a few years ago, Ramiza Shamoon-Koya, her novel, the Royal Abduls, which was rejected by several agents because she wrote about culturally Muslim characters and had the audacity to have them interested in STEM and other things as women. Does part of that come from your own experience as neurodivergent, a desire to give voice maybe to those who are underrepresented or excluded altogether?
Absolutely. I think it's so important. You know, this book, I went to press in January before the certain president took office. And I have so much in here that is about kindness and honoring everybody's identities. And now so much of that has been politicized. So it's really, I felt really glad I sent this to press before the language conversation shifted and became what it is, so toxic, how it's so toxic and full of stereotypes right now. But it's something I've always believed. Fiction is hard too, because I want everybody to be able to imagine. I want people to imagine their scary monsters or their silly tea parties or whatever. We should be able to imagine anything we want. I love that.
But there has to be an authenticity to it, doesn't it?
Yeah. When you imagine something that steps on someone else's identity in a way that could potentially supersede their identity or be louder than how loud they get to be in the world, that's not okay.
And I can see, old movies that had like an African-American character that was written by white people. In fact, the show Amos and Andy, two white guys, a very popular show on the radio for a long time, or you get kind of the gay sidekick in movies now written by a straight white guy.
Yep.
You know, and it's just annoying really to watch. It's formulaic and stupid.
I'm glad you brought Annie up with Soul Jar, our disability anthology, because she came to me with that idea because so much science fiction and fantasy fixes disability or cures disability or erases disability because now there are these new protocols or these new pieces of tech that can support disabled people. So woohoo, they're fine now, no problem. And it's really an identity erasure. And so her idea was wanting to have those stories set in alternative reality, fantastical or technologically futuristic, whatever, societies written by people with disabilities so they could write themselves into their stories instead of having able-bodied people write them out of their own stories.
So you got a perspective that we don't often see
totally.
In the books and entertainment that we read or view.
And I think, too, my neurodivergence influences how I write, how I read. I'm apparently a very long writer. I like to write long.
500 pages, and I read you probably cut about another 100, right?
Oh my gosh. I have interviews that I cut, whole swaths of amazing content that just got left behind on the cutting room floor. I probably have, 20 different file folders of pieces of this book, some of which made it into the final, and a lot just dropped away.
Now, you have a section on the different types of publishing, which we kind of talked about a little before, from the big five traditional presses to small indie presses to hybrids to DIY or self-publishing. Can you talk about these types, maybe starting with the big five? And I wrote them down just so people will know. Penguin, Random House, Macmillan, Simon & Schuster, Hachette, and HarperCollins. And you say in the book that at one time when you started, it was Big 10, then Big 7, now Big 5. Who knows what it will be in a few years?
Totally.
Big 4, Big 3.
Yeah, someone said Big 4 the other day, and I was like, oh, my book already went to press. Oh, well. the traditional big New York houses have so much in terms of their systems are so steady, and they have so many employees. They have bigger budgets. One of my friends who's been published on a big five for many years as a children's book author said it's kind of like the Titanic. It's a giant ship that's going in one direction. And if you need to change direction, you can't just turn the wheel and you just have to do it in increments. There's a lot of benefit to being with a big five because
they can promote the book.
They can promote the book.
They have distribution and sales reps.
Exactly. They have a lot of positives. And they have so many people just working for their companies that they can send out a book to their staff members. And that gets it so many reads right away. They have in-house promotions that share their books among each other. And that's an audience. Like, That's yeah, a whole micro segment of an audience that can then go out and build buzz for the book.
Yeah, in fact, you said at Powell's that if a big press decides to make a title a bestseller, they can do that.
Yeah, yep.
They just put all their resources behind it.
Yeah, yeah, and that's how they work. And if you're not that best-selling author, you get a different experience. Small presses are my love, and I wish I had known that when I was a younger author. With, like I said, if I had started looking for a small press with my earlier version of Singing Lessons for the Stylish Canary, I think that version or one of those versions would have found a home. Small presses are, they range depending on how many employees they have, what their budget is, how many books they have a season. Some small presses are actually, I like to call the bigger small presses independent presses. We're all independent, but a company like Sourcebooks is a giant independent that has lots of bestsellers, and it has a lot of advantages like the New York presses do, but it's its own woman-owned company. And then hybrid can be very confusing, but basically anytime the author is expected to pay something toward the publication of the book, that's my definition of hybrid. It's pretty simple. Authors often choose to go on book tours and they pay for those. That's different than the publisher saying, you have to give us money. Like, we need you to pay into this pot if you sign our contract, is hybrid.
Now, Laura, many writers feel they have to get an agent interested in their book. You felt the same way.
I did, for sure.
Rather than directly submitting to a publisher or a small press. Now, what's the role of an agent, and when are they needed, and when are they not needed? When can you forego that process?
Well, agents are wonderful, and a lot of writers choose that path. You really need an agent to get to the big five, the New York traditional houses, and a lot of the smaller independents require agents.
There's no over-the-transom submissions to Simon & Schuster.
Or even Milkweed or Grey Wolf. Those are two of many that only Sourcebooks, a lot of Chronicle, a lot of the big independents require agents as well. So if you're looking to build a career in terms of getting a financially lucrative deal, or if you're looking to publish book after book after book and grow your reputation, you might want to start with an agent and see how that goes. Now, if you're writing poetry, or if you write short story collections or essay collections, those are not as marketable to the big five, and you might want to start with a small press. So it really depends. But in addition to selling your book, hopefully, to a publisher, your agent is a handholder, or can be.
Can be a developmental editor, like in your case.
Yeah, it can be an amazing developmental editor, can help you understand what you've written and find sales language for it. Often, authors who try to write their own query letters and explain what they've written don't actually nail it in the way that somebody who reads thousands of query letters can nail it. So an agent can help you set up a proposal if you're trying to sell your nonfiction title to a press. They can help make sure that your packet of materials is as strong as it could be. And then there are all the things that happen along the way of publication, where with a small press, the author either has to complain to their editor or publisher or ask questions. Anytime relationship could be fraught, your agent can step in instead. So let's say you have an agent and your book goes out and gets a deal, and they come back with a cover that is offensive to you. Not just bad, but just offensive.
You don't have to deal directly with a publisher on that. Yeah, the agent can give them the bad news.
Exactly. The agent can approach it in a safe and kind, reasonable way that won't damage your relationship with your editor. So
now, we mentioned if a big five press wants to make a bestseller, they can. They have the resources to do that. But not every big five author gets that attention. And you mentioned debut authors are certainly most of them, and also mid-list authors. But that's not true at a small press, certainly not true at Forest Avenue. You've said that every book you publish is the top of your list, and every author gets the press's personal attention.
It's true. That's one of the benefits of working with a small press, is we're real people and we do this for love. We do this for wanting to support the writers we choose. And so, yeah, my writers get a lot of hands-on attention from me. Some of them call me, some of them text me, some of them email me. And we're often in communication for years after the book comes out, too.
Oh, and I've interviewed quite a few of them, and they always have wonderful things to say about you. So it's a great relationship between publisher and author. Now, we should mention another writer you interviewed in the book, Keith Rawson, because it's an interesting case study. He started publishing with small presses, then was picked up by a big five publisher, and I think is doing fairly well now with two or three titles out. So his sales have increased, but he said it was more fun working with the small press.
Yeah, when I interviewed him, he was, I think, working on his second book for the big five, and so there was a lot more pressure in terms of the content that was expected, I think. And it was really great to be able to interview him because he's one of those, sometimes people say, and it's not true, Keith proves it's not always true, that if you want to have big deals and be on that New York circuit with your book, that you should start there and get the deal and go forward. And in his case, he got some great small press titles out there, really well written. Meerkat Press was really supportive of his career, I think. And he changed agents, and his agent sold his next book to a big editor for money. So I think it's wonderful that he's had all this success. And now he is writing. I mean, I think he's always written so much. He is really prolific. But Stephen King has posted about his books. And
that's the best blurb you can get.
Yeah, he has made it from any standpoint of making it. And I'm so happy for him.
I want to talk about one of your favorite topics. At least you said this at the Powell's event. Distribution.
Woohoo!
And I'm quoting from the book, "Distribution will impact your book more than any other factor. It's also the biggest difference between small presses." And you explain the different types of distribution in the book. So full service, no frills, print on demand, and self-distribution. I can see how authors get confused, but a small press like Forest Avenue has kind of full distribution as opposed to maybe another small press that doesn't.
Yes.
And that really determines how well that book's going to do in the market.
I have so many friends who sign contracts with publishers who are great publishers, and their staff members or staff member is great at doing the publishing things, but it can be really hard to get those books into bookstores if they are print on demand and if there are no returns allowed from the publisher. If the publisher sets a print on demand book for no returns or for a shorter discount than usual, booksellers can't afford to take chances on buying them and bringing them in.
And with the returns is interesting, you explain in the book, because a bookseller, unlike most retailers, if the product doesn't sell, they can return it for a full refund.
Yep.
And that really hurts the publisher.
Well, and it's not just the money that you think you've earned that suddenly you have suddenly just gets swooshed out like the bathtub draining or something. There goes your profit. Sorry, sucker. No. But also we pay a fee to our distributor for handling the return. And so it actually costs us a little bit per book every time a book gets returned. And I get it, because bookstores have limited square footage. They need to focus on books that are out now that people are going to walk into the store and ask for by name or by cover. And a lot of those are the big five. But I also know independent bookstores are champions of independent presses, and they curate what's on their bookshelves based on what they think their clients and customers will want, and often open up their space for all of us independent small press authors and publishers to have events. And to me, that's why we do all of this. I mean, I've never been a big believer in buying things online, but I actually founded Forest Avenue kind of inside Powell's with the Espresso Book Machine, and to have bookstores support small presses, and to have customers walk into a small bookstore whenever they're traveling and see local voices on the shelf or see something different that they wouldn't have run across even on TikTok or social media in any form is really special. And to me, that's community.
And such an important part of the community, like Annie Bloom's. I mean, that's where you started your writing group. Little upstairs room, huh?
Yeah. It's such a sweet bookstore. It's probably the one that I've known the most for the longest. Mm. So, yeah.
Now, another big topic for writers, marketing promotion. And I know most of them are, yes, you're putting your hand to your forehead. A lot of them are more introverted. And then most people don't want to really just blow their own horn all the time, which is what social media seems to be doing. How important is it for building and maintaining a social media platform? Is it critical? Is it necessary?
Oh, this is a tough question, Ken. I have mixed feelings about it because there are agents and editors at publishing houses who look at social media stats and make a decision about a book. If you don't have a platform, your book's not going to sell because you don't have people to sell it to.
Yeah, that's what I hear. That seems to be the common knowledge.
But that being said, we shouldn't be valuing art and intellect based on clicks and likes and numbers of followers. So I tend to be, I don't ask my authors to be on all the platforms. I don't ask my authors to have a certain number. Do I look them up? I guess at a certain point in submissions land, when we're winnowing down and we have a couple we're really interested in, yeah, sure, we'll look up the website or we'll look up social media. But I'm not looking up to look for counts. I'm looking to see if that person is relating to other people on a personal level, if they're being genuine online, because genuine is very much my brand. If you can't tell, that's my thing, authenticity or being genuine. And social media is one of those places where you can do all smoke and mirrors and not be genuine. But if I look up an author and it looks like they're online as a real person, that's what I'm looking for.
Now, in the book's acknowledgments, and this is the first I have heard about it, but I looked it up on your website too, you start an experiment called the DIY Book Publicity Group,
yeah,
which a writer has to pay to join, but that's really to take care of expenses. It's through Forest Avenue Press, but this helps writers who can't afford a publicist or who might be, you know, very awkward,
yeah,
at building their own social media platforms.
Well, it's so hard when you're by yourself trying to promote a book. I mean, I even felt a little lost when I was working with Lanternfish getting my first book out. There were moments where I didn't know, should I be writing essays right now? Should I be starting a newsletter? Should I be taking more photos?
Hiring a publicist.
Yeah, which
you said
I
could be like $20,000.
Yeah, publicists can be really expensive. And so I wanted to subvert that power structure, because the people who can afford big name publicists or any publicist are people who get big bucks for their advances and they put that advance money into a publicist. But that leaves the rest of us out in the cold, and in a social media and online marketplace, that makes our books really hard to discover. So we need to figure out ways around that and do it ourselves. And there are a lot of questions that come up in publishing when you are, especially when you're a debut, and there, you can't keep asking your editor or even your agent a million questions every week. So number one, there needs to be more communication between parties in publishing. But number two, publicity, having somebody that you can talk to about, is this a good idea? Have you tried this? What's working? I run the DIY publicity group through a little project I have just to try it and see how it works. But I am, I guess, the teacher. I'm the leader. But a lot of the time I invite our cohort members to speak up about things. One of them is really great at podcasts. Someone else is really great at like getting newsletter subscribers and using tools, online tools, to increase readership and to capture interest in newsletters So they present also.
So it's a way to pool resources and knowledge.
Exactly. And I wanted to do something that was super limited in scope. So I said 20, 25 titles and a small fee to just focus and have skin in the game and want to stay with it and be with it. And so we meet on Zoom twice a month and we have a Discord channel and it's pretty amazing. I think of it as an experiment because mostly I wanted company as Imagine a Door was launching. And I thought, well, we should like, maybe we can all get together and do a thing together. And then I can answer all the questions I would have been trying to answer for people anyway. So,
speaking of questions, I have one. This came from that PALS launch, which is a wonderful event. A lot of your writers were there, your colleagues, friends from all over the literary community, Portland and the Pacific Northwest. And at the the Q&A session at the end, you got a question from Eleanor, who's a fourth grader, apparently already thinking of writing her own book. And she asked you, how do you write a successful one? Do you remember what you told her?
I thanked her so much for being there originally, like the beginning, because I got all teary-eyed because I was writing in fourth grade. And what I told her was to focus on the stories she can tell, because nobody else could tell the stories that she could tell. And I remember being 10 and wanting to write an adult book, or wanting to like write something that stood up there with everybody else. And I wonder what it would have been like if I had written from my perspective as a fourth grader, you know, and done it that way. Yeah, she was fabulous. And
a book
I hope
about
she keeps
that,
writing.
A book about that red rubber ball.
Totally.
You also, I think your eldest daughter, didn't she print her own book?
Yeah.
Wrote a book and printed
we did
it out?
Yeah, we did it together as a small story collection.
So you're the best person for Eleanor to ask.
Yeah.
Plus you gave her advice that I think works for writers of any age.
For sure. Afterwards, she and her mom came up and we talked a little bit more. So that was sweet, too.
So one last question, and this is not from Eleanor. This is from me. But you have a section in the book about your love of roller derby and its influence on your career as a publisher and a writer. And in fact, before we got together this afternoon, it's a Sunday afternoon, you were taking photos of a junior league roller derby game, two games, starting at 9 in the morning. Now, what did you learn from your own roller derby experience? You know, getting into the sport, you said in your mid-40s.
Yeah, I didn't stay in it for too long, but I loved the power of starting something completely new, completely bonkers to even think about doing. And they taught us all how to fall really well. And for me, that's a metaphor that's carried through in my publishing work. And I've even done a keynote speech about roller derby and book writing because the importance of not being afraid to fail and not being afraid to fall. If you fall correctly, if you fail well, there's a lot of synergy there.
You also mentioned in the book the practice it took. In other words, you weren't fast and strong and skilled all at once. It was practice after practice after practice, and eventually you saw progress.
Yep. You can learn how to do a certain stop one way, and you can practice it and you can get it. But then, you know, you keep doing that stop for 3 months and you'll see a marked improvement. You stop faster, you stop with more precision, you stop better. And I would say the same thing about writing if you keep going and keep trying. But I love circling back to the idea of practice, because so much of what I have felt as a writer is pressure to publish and pressure to make it right, to make it perfect. But there's no such thing as perfect in art. And when we take away those expectations and remembering that we're living in a capitalist society, and we just sit down and play with words, or play on our skates, or play with watercolors, or play the piano.
That's when good things happen.
Yeah, we're nurturing those pieces of ourselves that are not for the content machine. They're not for anybody else. And we can find joy in those moments.
Well, Laura, thanks so much for talking with us today and giving me joy talking with you. Thanks for all you do also for our Portland and Pacific Northwest literary community. The new book, I think, is a gift to writers everywhere.
Thank you so much, Ken.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Laura Stanfill, author of the new book, Imagine a Door, A Writer's Guide to Unlocking Your Story, Choosing a Publishing Path, and Honoring the Creative Journey, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. Laura will be reading at Portland's Annie Bloom's Books on Monday, April 28th, in conversation with Liz Prado. And she'll be appearing at the Terwa Creative Writing Festival in Dayton, Oregon, on Saturday, May 3rd. You can learn about all of Laura's events and her work online at laurastanfill.com. And you can sign up for her newsletter at laurastanfill.substack.com. Just a reminder that KBOO is in the final days of our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign going on through April 15th. You can check out our full list of specials and marathons at kboo.fm/ATNF4. And if you'd like to help keep those thrills coming, you can make a one-time or sustaining contribution by going to kboo.fm/give or just text KBOO to 44321. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, April 24th. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
imagine a door. You turn the handle and find yourself in a kitchen, courtyard, underground cave, jungle, corporate boardroom, bedroom, cockpit, dark alley, school. You hear a car alarm, branches moving in the wind, water droplets, an unfamiliar bird call.